So today we're going to talk about Naropa and Naropa's six yogas. And I'd like to start just straight from the lineage. So I thought first thing we'd talk about today is the lineage. How does this teaching come down to us? And it's really the story of all the great lamas and gurus who have taught this teaching. And I like it because I think each teacher who passed down this teaching has their own story. And I like to hear those stories because they had a lot of trouble in their practice. They went through many tests with their lamas, especially in this particular lineage. Like, you don't get this lineage unless you go through a lot of trouble. So, to me, I like to hear about all the trouble they went through. Then it makes my life seem a little easier, you see? So, here's how Naropa got this teaching. Naropa, his name is, sometimes they call him Naropa, which would mean Naraupa. Naraupa means highest of all men, highest of all humans. And the Nara came into English in the word Nero, the Roman emperor, which meant big man or highest man. So Naro and Upa means up. So Naraupa becomes Naropa. Sometimes they call him Narotapa, which means the same thing, highest of all living beings. And then sometimes he called Nadapada. Nada means the inner channels, like nadis. And then pada normally means like respectful one, like foot. Like at your respectful feet, I bow. Like the lotus feet of the inner channels or something like that. You could call him Nadapada. That was probably his real name. And the Tibetans chose to translate his name as Tsache. In very rare texts, it's very hard to find, but we found it. And Tsache means, Tsa means your inner channels. And She means the one who can explain them to you properly. So Pada can also mean a section of explanation, like the parts of the Yoga Sutra are called the four Padas. So his name either means highest of all living creatures, or it means the one who can explain the inner channels to us. Nadapada, okay? How did he start out? He started out, he got ordained, or he started getting interested in Buddhism. He was a prince, of course. All these people are princes. Atisha, Shantideva. He was a prince in India. When he was 7 years old, he started to take an interest in Dharma. When he was 11, and he was given a preliminary ordination. When he was 11, he walked to Kashmir. This is 1,000 miles away from where he was born. And he studied. He started to study with the great yogis and pandits there in Kashmir. I think it's interesting to look at what he studied because I think he's meant to be a model for us. You know, what he studied, maybe we should be studying, right? So on his first trip to Kashmir, he studied Kalachakra Tantra, which is being given by His Holiness this week, I think, in Toronto. And Kalachakra is, you know, His Holiness doesn't go into great detail when he's teaching 5,000 people he's never met before. But Kalachakra Tantra is very important for yoga and for the practice of higher yoga inside your body. Kalachakra is very important. So we know that he was affected by that. Then he studied the works of Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti is a logician. He's just talking about how to prove things. And logic is important in the monastery. It's the first thing you ever learn. Every year you do 3 months of logic in the winter. And it's tied together with perceptual theory. How do you perceive objects? How do you know a car is a car? How do you know a cow is a cow? And it's a very beautiful subject. So here you've got this 11-year-old getting fed logic, perceptual theory, and Kalachakra in the same dosage, you know? Very powerful subjects. Then he comes back. He spends 5 years in Kashmir. He comes back 6 years. He comes back at the age of 17. His parents are putting pressure on him to get married. And he doesn't want to be married. He wants to be a monk. So he says, if you can find a girl, you know, I have to respect you, my parents. So if you can find a girl who's a Brahmin, but inside she's a Mahayana Buddhist, and if her name is Nirmala, which means like a stainless one, and, you know, if she has these 42 other impossible qualities, then I'll marry her, you know. But you have to find her. That's your problem. So they send out two ministers to find this impossible girl, and they find her. And she's in this village, and her father's a Brahmin, and when he hears that they want a Brahmin daughter to marry, he's not a Brahmin. He's a royal Kshetra family. So it's like, I don't know. It's a completely improper marriage in India. So anyway, but the ministers camp out on the front step of the house, and they say, we're not leaving and we're not eating until you surrender your daughter to the prince. So the father says, I don't care if you starve, and he goes in. But the townspeople start to raise an outcry. And after a while, the father breaks down because they start to pass out, the two ministers. So they bring the girl back, and Naropa meets her. His name at this point is Abhayakirti, which means fearless one, the one with no fear, his monk's name. So he's not Naropa yet, okay? His name is Abhayakirti, which is Jigme in Tibetan. That's why so many people in Tibet are called Jigme. So anyway, no fear. He comes back, they get married, and they stay married for, I think, 8 years, something like 8 years. And then Nirmala can tell that her husband isn't really, he has other things he needs to do, you know? And it seems that he taught her Tantra during this time, like during the years they were married, maybe 8 years, that he taught her highest teachings. And maybe she taught him. We'll get into that later. But then she made a very amazing offer. She said, you know, the only way in India to break a marriage is if the woman is unfaithful. So she said, I'll admit to cheating on you, and I'll lose all of my status in the community. You know, I'll become like a dog so that you can have your freedom, and you can go study in the monastery, you can practice more. So she does that. And she lies and says that she was unfaithful to him, that she committed adultery. And then the marriage is dissolved, and he runs to the monastery, you know. And he studies in Kashmir another 8 years in a place called Pushpahari, or Pulahari sometimes it's called. This is going to be famous later because he taught Marpa there. And then Nalanda Monastery is not far from this place, and he reached Nalanda Monastery, and he began to study there. After 8 years, he was so good at his studies, they declared him the abbot of Nalanda. Later, he became also the gatekeeper of Vikramalashila. These are the two great Buddhist monasteries of ancient India, like Saramay and Saramay. He becomes the gatekeeper. Gatekeeper is an important job. You stand at the front door of this church, for example. And then anybody from another religion, you know, like Baptist or Hindu or a Jewish person could come up to the front door and say, I challenge the gatekeeper to a debate. And then the gatekeeper has to do a public debate with the challenger, the person who came to the door. And then if the gatekeeper loses the debate, then all the 500 monks of Vikramashila, Buddhist monks, they have to take off their robes, put on whatever the opponent is wearing, and convert to the other religion, you see. So the stakes are very high, and there were six gatekeepers, but the big two were Naropa, was at the northern gate, some texts say a different gate, and then Prajnakaramati, who is responsible for our understanding Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He explained it properly, and that tradition has been carried on throughout Tibetan history. So here you've got, in the same monastery, Naropa's guarding one door, and then you've got Prajnakaramati, he's guarding the other door. These two intense, these great saints, you know. So he's a very important figure. He continues his study. He studies almost every tantra known. He studies Hebhadra, he studies Griha Samaja, he studies Chakrasambhara. He becomes the teacher of a future abbot of the monastery named Atisha. So he teaches Atisha both tantra and perfection of wisdom. Atisha later becomes the person who pretty much brings what we practice, Buddhism, into Tibet. So, you know, all the Lam Rim teachings come down through Lord Atisha. Lord Atisha also made a journey to Indonesia and brought the great teachings on Bodhicitta back to India. And that's how they got to Tibet. So we wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for Lord Atisha. So his teacher was Naropa. So Naropa loaded Atisha, okay? Then there's a very beautiful event. Naropa by this time is 41 years old. He's out in the garden somewhere outside the main monastery. He's reading a text on logic. He has his back to the setting sun. And then he sees this great shadow come across the book and his body. And he turns around and there's this old hag, this ugly old woman there. And she's like a homeless person, right? Like a bag lady. And she stinks. There's a list of 37 different bad qualities she has in the scriptures, okay? Like, she's just really gross, okay? And she, you know, like, wanders around to the front, and she leans over with her bad breath, and she says, well, what are you doing, you know? Who are you? He says, I'm Naropa. I'm like the abbot and the gatekeeper, you know? I'm this great... It's like the president of Harvard, right? And then she says, well, what are you doing there? And he says, I am studying higher teachings on logic and philosophy, you know. And she says, oh, that's impressive, you know. Do you understand it? And he says, of course I understand it. I'm Naropa, you know. Actually, this time he's a Abhayakirti. So she says then, well, do you understand the words or do you understand the meaning? You know. And then he thinks a moment and he says, I understand the words. And then she breaks into this dance, this beautiful, joyous dance. And she's dancing, flying through the air, whirling, you know, and she's laughing. And then he says, wait, I also understand the meaning. And then she falls on the ground and she starts wailing and crying and she's angry and she's upset and she's screaming, you know. And then he says, wait, stop, what are you doing, you know? Why, first you're dancing when I say I understand the meaning and then you're, sorry, when I understood the words. And now you're crying when I said I understood the meaning, you know. And he says, she said, when you said you understood the words, I believed you, you know. And I was happy. Because I thought I meant an honest monk, because I thought you meant you didn't understand the meaning. You just understood the words. Then you said you understood the meaning also. And I thought, oh, I haven't met an honest monk. And she started to cry, you know. Because you don't understand the meaning. He says, if I don't understand the meaning of the holy books, then who does? And she says, Tilopa, of course. He says, who's Tilopa? Tilopa is my brother. You know? Well, tell him to come here and teach me the words and the meaning also. You know? And she says, you don't ask your guru to come to you. You go and beg your guru to teach you. And then she disappears like that. You know? And then he's like, wow, maybe it's something special going on, you know? And he went back to the monastery, and I can imagine in Saramaya, the abbot's quarters are on top of the roof, and there's a special staircase to get up there, you know, and you have to have permission to even get in the door of the staircase, you know. So he's up in his abbot's quarters, and he's thinking all night, you know. The next morning, he comes out to the monks, you know, 500 monks. This is the greatest monastery there ever was in India, a Buddhist monastery. And he comes out and he says, I'm leaving the monastery. And he takes off his robes and he puts on a rag around his waist, a yogi's rag. I think you can see it in the reading. We have a wood carving on it from the Potala Palace. He puts on a rag and he says, I'm leaving. And they're like scandalized, you know. 500 monks are crying. The gatekeepers run and they beg him, what's going on? You're crazy, you know. You're crazy, you know. Put your robes back on. Are you crazy? You know, you're the foundation of the whole monastery. You know, you're the greatest scholar we have. You're the example for all the other monks. you can't take off your robes, put on a rag, and walk away. You know, and he says, I have to. I have to find my teacher, you know. So I think already there's a great lesson. You see, he was willing to give up everything. He had the whole open teachings down, right? He knew the 18 ACI courses. No, he'd been through all of those subjects very well. And he had every reason to be satisfied and just to relax. You know, he understood those teachings, the open teachings, very well. And in those days, you learned a lot of Tantra in the Sutra monasteries also. So he had a lot, he had all this knowledge. And he couldn't have just stopped, you know. He could have just relaxed the way we do, you know. And he said, no, I need to find out more. You know, I have to, he really wanted to get enlightened, you see. And I think even in Tibet now, or in the monasteries, there's this sort of a, if you become a Geshe or an abbot, it's kind of easy to stop and just relax. You have a very good position for the rest of your life. You'll be fed. People will respect you. You'll have large classes. People will bow down to you. You know, it's very tempting to stop and relax. And he said, no, I have to get enlightened. You know, so he left the monastery. And the king came and begged him to stay and threatened him. And the monks began to threaten him. He said, no, I'm leaving. And he just went out. Then I don't know, 8 months or 10 months, he's looking for Talopa in the forest. In those days when you went to practice Tantra, you just walked out into the forest with nothing, with a rag on. And he just walked out. Talopa is somewhere. Where's Talopa? Who is Talopa? We don't know much, okay? There's not much that we know about him. He was originally a high priest for a king in southern India, we think. Purohita means in charge of the rituals for a king. And this is a cushy job. You know, you're like the biggest monk in the whole state, and you're working for the most wealthy person in the state, and they shower you with gifts, and all you have to do is like take care of the water bowls or something, and do a ritual here and there. It's called Shakten in the monastery nowadays. Like, you can send people out for Shakten, they go to people's houses, you recite anything because they don't know what you're saying. And you can even just recite the same 3 pages over about 6 times. Then you get a huge dinner and they put $100 in a red envelope and hand it to you. And, you know, no, I mean, this is a nice job he had. And so one day, Talopa got fed up with that and walked out to the, they call it burial ground and charnel ground. And in India, you know, in the old days, you just took dead people out to the fields, like, and you just threw the body there, you know. And then wild animals would come and eat it, and they would rot, and they would stink. And it was a very frightening place to be. Like, in those days, there were lots of tigers, there were lots of jackals, like mountain lion type of animals. And it was very dangerous to spend the night on a charnel ground. So Talopa left his cushy job, he walked out, he went to the charnel ground, and he did his practice sitting on a dead body, on the chest of a dead body. He would take the person's head and cut off the skull, cut the skull out, and make bowls out of it for his food. He would eat their brains for dinner. I mean, he's trying to teach himself about death. It's not some kind of weird, what do you call it nowadays? What's that witch stuff did this do? No, that's another word. Wiccan. Yeah, it's not some Wiccan thing. It's not like that. It's not a weird thing like that. It's like a very pure person, a very moral person, a very upstanding person would go out, sit on a dead body, and do their meditations there. Just to remember their own death, you see? To get in touch with where we really are, right? Like, we're all going to be laying out on a slab. In what? A week, a month, a year, we don't know. You see, I've been called to pray for those people, you know, in the Mongolian community. We serve people for their whole lifetimes, and then when they die, they call us. We go to the mortuary. I've seen them. They're laid out on a marble table. There are tubes in their body to drain the blood off. It's pouring into these stainless steel sinks. And they're sitting there like dead meat, and you do these prayers to make the family happy, and you know there's nothing you can do for them. So it's very much a meditation on death. It's one thing to meditate on death in the comfort of your home, with a Lam Rim book in your lap, you know. It's another thing to sit on a dead body and do your prayers, you know, and he would do that. So that's a lesson also, I think. You know, he wanted to remember that he would die at any minute. And that was a custom in India. So Tilopa, after that, just took off and wandered around in the forest. Naropa goes out to find him. And he goes through 8 months of search, and it's a very sad story. I mean, he sees all these, what do you call it, hallucinations. Like he'll see someone who looks like Naropa, and he'll run and run and run, and he'll never catch him. Or he'll get grabbed by somebody and they'll beat him up. Or, you know, he'll think someone can help him, and then they'll cheat him. And then finally, after months and months, Naropatha is in the forest, and he says, it's not going to happen. In this lifetime, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to meet Tilopa. So I'll just do the best prayers I can that I would meet him in my future life. And then he gets a razor blade, and he starts to cut his wrist, you see? He starts to commit suicide. And then suddenly Tilopa appears, you know, wait, stop. I'll teach you. Don't worry, you know. It's very beautiful. So, to think that somebody even like Naropa, who brought all of Tantra to Tibet, okay? If you studied Kalachakra, it's because Naropa brought it to Tibet. If you studied Hevajra, Guhyasamaja, Chakrasambhara, Mahamudra, these all came through Naropa. Naropa brought all of them to Tibet. The whole Sakya lineage is based on Naropa's teaching of Vajrayogini. The whole Kagyu lineage is based on Marpa's teachings of the six yogas of Naropa. The whole Shangba Kagyu is based on Niguma's teaching. Niguma will come later, okay? They're all coming from Naropa and Tilopa. So here he is. He's the person who's going to bring hope for enlightenment in one lifetime to all of Tibetans. And he's got a razor blade on his wrist, you see. It makes me feel like my life's not so hard. You see what I mean? If Naropa can be in a position to kill himself because he can't find his teacher and he's sad, then, I don't know, I feel encouraged in a way, you see. So anyway, Tilopa swears he'll teach him. Then he takes Naropa through 12 terrible stages of teaching. Every stage involves a different kind of abuse. Like the first day starts out on the top of a Chinese tower, a three-story tower. If you see them in India, they still exist. Like we were in Shravasti, there's one there. And you walk up like it's a lighthouse or something like that. So you're at the top of this lighthouse. And Tilopa says to Naropa, if I had a good student, they would jump off this roof, you know. So Naropa's like, okay. And he jumps, you know. And then he's down there at the bottom, and his body's all broken up and mangled, and he's got broken bones. By the way, I'm not suggesting it, and I'm not asking you to jump off roofs, okay? I'm just relating a story. We give harder tests nowadays. So he's all mangled on the ground. His teacher, Tilopa, comes over. What are you doing on the ground? Oh, my body's all broken. What do you mean you don't get up when your teacher comes? What's wrong with you? You know? And so he doesn't get any sympathy from day one. And it goes on like that through 12 different tests, you see? And tests are, I know, these tests sound not so bad, you know, like I sit there, I say somebody jumped off a roof, and you're like, okay, he jumped off a roof. But we know it turns out all right. We know the end of the story, right? He becomes this great yogi and saves the Tibetan people, you know? So we know everything turned out all right. But tests are very, how do you say? Your lama will always come up with the test that you can't do. You see? It might not be, jumping off a roof is easy. That's very clear. Oh, okay, just jump, you know? The lamas will test you in more subtle ways, you see? Lamas will give you things to do that you really have doubts, and it tortures you to try to decide what's the right thing to do. This is what the relationship is. So, when you hear about these tests, you have to relate it. I think about how your own lamas have tested you. And just be watching out for tests. Because the nature of a test is when you're in the middle of a test, you can't do it. You see what I mean? They'll find what it is that you can't do, and they'll ask you to do it. You see what I mean? Why? Because they're mean or something? That's just the way the magic goes between a lama and a student. Once you commit yourself, if you don't commit yourself, there's no test. Okay? There won't be any tests. If you like just go on the weekends to hear somebody, there won't be any tests and you're fine. Okay? Once you commit yourself to a teacher, once you really commit yourself, that commitment creates the tests. You see? It's not like lamas sit around at night and try to figure out what would most annoy you. It's not like that. I mean, it seems like that, but it's not like that. They just get up in the morning and they see you and the test is already happening. If you have faith, if you have devotion, if you believe in the Lama, if you committed yourself to the Lama, then the test will come. Because the test hinges on whatever stuff you haven't cleaned up yet. So auto test. It's an automatic test. Whatever stuff you still have inside of you, which is not pure yet, it'll come out in your Lama's presence, and that will be your test. So they're not testing you, you're testing yourself. So anyway, Tilopates Naropala through 12 very painful tests. I mean, we're talking burning bamboo shoots stuck in his body, you know, standing in a swamp, mud full of poo-poo for like a year and trying to build a house that keeps falling down. And I don't know, some of you have probably done that at Vajrapani or LMB, I don't know. Something like that, okay? And really terrible tests. Like one day there's a wedding procession coming down the road, the prince is getting married to this beautiful girl. Tilopa says to Naropa, if I had a good disciple, they would drag the prince down and beat him up, and the princess, and the bride. So he does, you know, and then he gets beaten to a pulp, you know, by the guards. And like this, it goes on like that for 12 tests. But after each test, Tilopa grants Naropa one of the great instructions, one of 12 great instructions. And these are the basis of all higher tantric practice. In our whole lineage, okay, in the Galupa lineage and in the Kagyu lineage, also Sakya, okay, it's the basis for all higher practice, Dzogren practice. These 12 teachings that, you know, he had to get beat up for each one, right? And then after each one, he got one of them. And these 12 are the basis for all our higher teachings in Tibet. Later, they got shortened to 6 yogas, okay? 6 different practices that are known. We call them the 6 yogas of Naropa. And there's even a debate now, even in Tsongkhapa's time, there was an argument about what are the 6? I mean, they're so secret that there was an argument about which 6 they are. And in our monastery, in the great Galupa monasteries, you're not allowed to study the 6 yogas openly. You study them secretly. They were passed down that way. How did they get passed down? I want you to know your lineage, you know. I want you to know how it got to you, all right? So, Naropa received these instructions. Tilopa passed away after 12 years that they were together. And then there was a Tibetan. His name is Marpa Lotsawa, the translator. Chöki Lodur, he's called, in Tibetan. He was born into a farmer's family in the southeast of Tibet, called Dopo. And his parents were, you know, sort of like semi-wealthy. And he grew up, and he was a really, really rotten child, terrible kid. And his parents decided to get rid of him. So they said, Marpa, you should go study Sanskrit, you know. Well, the only Sanskrit teacher around was in southwest Tibet. So they sent him to learn from this Sanskrit teacher. And he went and he studied basic Sanskrit with this teacher. In those days, you had to pay high fees in Tibet. I mean, people would go to India at great risk and come back with some tantra or some kind of instructions. And then they would charge you a lot of money to learn them. And they had to pay gold dust, So one day Marpa got like fed up. He said, I should just go to India myself and save the money. You know, so he went back to his parents and he said, will you give me my inheritance early? You know, and they're like, they work it out and they decide just to get rid of him because he's apparently a really obnoxious child. And they agree that he can go to Tibet, sorry, go to India with his inheritance. So he goes to Nepal. He spends a year trying to acclimate to the lower altitude. And during that time, he meets the Pamtingpa brothers. These are five brothers who, Nepalese, who later brought Vajrayogini teachings to Tibet. Okay? So they tell him that if you're going to study with anybody, you could just go study with Naropa. Naropa knows everything. So he goes to India, he meets Naropa. And Naropa takes him through some pretty bad tests, three times, three different trips. On the last trip, Naropa even refuses to teach him and takes off into the forest. And then Marpa has to spend like a year trying to find him. Okay, that's another whole story. At the end, he gives Naropa a bag of gold. Naropa throws it on the ground, spills the gold dust all over the ground. Then Naropa touches the ground and it turns to gold. He says, I don't need your gold, you know. If I want to teach you, I'll teach you. So Marpa got the instructions. Then Marpa came back to Tibet. His student was Milarepa. Milarepa came, showed up one day. Marpa was out farming. Marpa was a businessman. He never became a monk. He got married nine times. Okay? He had nine spiritual partners. The last one was called Dagmema. And these are believed to be nine tantric angels who lived with him. And he practiced with them. So when Milarepa showed up, Marpa was out plowing his fields. And Marpa was, you know, a businessman, basically. So Milarepa said, do you know where Marpa is? And Marpa said, I don't know, but if you plow the rest of this field, I'll tell you where he is. You know, so he... From the first moment, he's giving Milarepa something to do. And you know the story. Milarepa found out that was Marpa later. Marpa made him do many things, like build a nine-story tower, which is still there in Tibet. He had to carry the stones on his own back. And then for years, Marpa refused to give him any instructions, any teachings. So Milarepa went through, I don't know, I think it's 7 years of torture. And Marpa would think up new ways of giving him trouble, you know. And so what we do nowadays isn't much, you know. To be director of some little Dharma center in California is easy compared to that, okay? Like that. That's not such a big deal. Towards the end of his torture, Milarepa got, impatient. And Marpa's wife, Dagmema, which means no self-nature lady, lady of no self-nature, she pitied Milarepa and said, I'll set you up with another lama. You know, between us, you can go get initiations from this lama, Lok Lama, you know. And she set it up. She went to Marpa's personal chest, swiped a ruby that Naropa had given to Marpa, and gave it to Milarepa and said, you take this to Ngog Lama, he'll recognize it, then he'll give you all the initiations. Then you don't have to worry with my cranky husband, you know. So he did. He didn't know the score, right? And he went to Ngog Lama, he offered the ruby, Ngog Lama recognized it and gave him all the initiations, thinking that Marpa had approved it, right? Then Marpa found out about it. He tortured both Dagmema and Milarepa more. And then finally, at some point, he gave Milarepa this teaching, the six yogas of Naropa. You should know, I think the lesson that we're supposed to learn from Marpa is that you can be a family person, and you can even be a business person, and you can be the greatest yogi in Tibet. You see what I mean? In those days, the lineage was passed down through people who were family people. And Marpa never got ordained. He had a business. He was a pretty wealthy farmer. Nowadays, he would be running the local grocery store. He would own it, and he'd be running it or something. And he had a very deep, high spiritual life, and he was the foundation of Tantra in Tibet. 25 of the Tantras in the Kangyur and Tengyur were translated written by Naropa, translated by Marpa, you see? So, anyway, he taught Milarepa. You should know, I think the lesson we're supposed to learn from Milarepa is that he was almost 50 when he started his serious practice. Okay, so I get students who come up to me and say, oh, you know, I'm too old, my back hurts, my knee hurts. You know, I've been trying to do it, but I can't do it. He wrote all his great He started his serious practice in the cave when he was 50, you see. So in those days, the life expectancy was 40. So I don't think you can say, if you're under 80 now, you can't like say you can't do it, okay? If Milarepa could do it, you could do it. He got all his realizations after the age of 50, okay? He started at that age. So I would say if you could get the six yogas of Naropa in a very pure lineage, then you wouldn't have a problem, right? You could practice. And we're going to talk about how you do that. Milarepa's big student was, he had many, but the big one for our lineage is Gampopa. Gampopa wrote a book called Namtar Gyan, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, it's been translated as. And the story about Gampopa is kind of cool, the story we're supposed to learn about Gampopa's life. He was married. He really wanted to be a monk. He wanted to go be a yogi somewhere. And then one day his wife died. And then her uncle came to the house. And he sat down and he said to Gampopa, you know, don't cry. Don't feel too bad. You know, everything is impermanent. It's really bad that your wife died. And we'll all support you. And you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to spend your time crying. And Gampopa says, are you kidding? This is like the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I'm so happy. You know, now I can get out of here and go practice, you know. It's like the most wonderful thing that could happen, you know. There's a story, the uncle picked up some dirt off the floor and threw it in his face and said, you heartless animal, you know, how could you speak about her this way? So Gampopa just split and started to practice. Okay? Then he practiced the six yogas of Naropa. Mm-hmm. Gampopa's student was Padmadrupa. Padmadrupa, he's interesting because it's Padmadrupa who finalized the yoga exercises that we are doing in the Heart Tibetan Book of Yoga. Okay, so if you were here last night, or if you are interested in those exercises, it's Padmadrupa who finalized those exercises in their final form. And that's the asanas that we do in the Galupa Monastery. So they don't teach you very easily. Oftentimes they only teach geshes, people who have finished their geshe. But if you do learn the yoga exercises, and many of them are in the Tibetan Book of Yoga, these were put into their final form by Padmadrupa, who is Gampopa's student. I like Padmadrupa because his other lama, his other tantric lama was Machik Labdrun. Machik Labdrun is one of the most famous women yogis of all of Tibet. And so he studied under her. Padmadrupa studied under both Gampopa and Machik Labdrun. So, I don't know, in the whole Kangyur, 4,500 books, I believe there's only three written by women, you see? Something like that. One is the lineage of Padmadrupa, one is the lineage of Niguma. Niguma is, you should know Niguma while we're on the subject. Niguma was Naropa's wife, his spiritual wife. So after she got him back into the monastery, Nirmala, right? She stuck and they practiced together and they stayed as a couple. And then after Naropa met Tilopa, he learned from Tilopa how to practice higher teachings as a spiritual couple together with your spiritual partner. And then he did those practices with his partner, whose name in Tibetan is called Niguma. This is the old girl from the Brahmin, okay? She stayed with him all those years. And then under Tilopa trained Naropa to do practices with a spiritual partner. Her name in Tibetan is Niguma. If you find the old books, her real name was Nirguna. Nirguna means she doesn't have any qualities of being self-existent. Okay? It's the same idea as Marpa's spiritual partner's name, Dagmema, which means the lady who has no self-existence. Now you can say lady of emptiness or something like that. So Niguma's real name is lady of emptiness. She was Naropa's partner his whole life. They practiced together the teachings for couples, sacred teachings, sacred practice for couples. And then later in Naropa's life, he sent Marpa to study with her. So she also trained Marpa. Then she would go to an island in northeast India called Sotha Island, and she would practice there. I think it's in the Ganges River, and she would practice. And there was a famous Tibetan named Kyungbo Nyanja, who lived about 1,000 years ago. He decided to go to India and learn secret Buddhism, right? So he went to India, he asked around, he said, has anyone seen the Buddha? Vajradhara. Has anyone seen the tantric form of Lord Buddha? Is there anybody in India who has seen them? And they would say, Niguma has. Niguma has seen that. Because you have to have reached one of the three top bodhisattva levels. There are 10 bodhisattva levels. You have to reach the top three to be able to see these beings. So, and that's where you stop seeing things as self-existent. So she reached that level. So they said, you have to go study with Niguma. So he went to Niguma. He went to this island. And he was frightened, I think it's interesting. This is what we're supposed to learn from Kyungbo Nyanja. He decided to do a mantra to protect himself on this frightening island. So he just said, I go for refuge in my teacher. You know, he didn't do Om Mani Padme Hum or any of these high mantras. He just said, I go for refuge. I go for refuge. I go for refuge. He just took refuge. And he repeated that over and over again. Then this beautiful thing happens. Niguma appears before him. They say at the height of 7 palm trees. I don't know. What? 100 feet in the air? 200 feet in the air? And she's surrounded by all these other dakinis. And she's all this beautiful lady. I think she's 80 by that time. But she looks like 16. And she's looking down at Kyungbo Nyanja. What do you want? You know, and he says, I want to learn tantra from you. I want to learn what Naropa taught. She says, that's her husband, right? Her spiritual husband. So she says, well, I won't teach you, and if you don't leave, I'll kill you. So he's like, he's not afraid. He keeps doing his mantra. He like closes his eyes. He gets out his gold bag, the necessary gold bag, right? And he holds it up in the air, and then he feels it taken away, and then he opens his eyes. This is a big bag of gold. And she like flies over the top of the forest and she throws the gold dust into the forest. And she comes back and says, well, you look pretty serious, I'll teach you. You know. So she grabs him, takes him to a mountaintop, gives him some of Naropa's 6 yogas. But then gives him what we call the 6 yogas of Niguma. So I think in our lineage, this has also been a very secret practice. The second Dalai Lama practiced Niguma's yogas very seriously. The Shangba tradition of Kagyu, which is Kalu Rinpoche's lineage, have practiced it very seriously. And we will be studying this yoga in Arizona, this particular form of yoga. Because I think it's time in this world that women teach these teachings, and that we go to, that we learn the women's lineages seriously. So Niguma's would be perfect, I think. So Kyungbo Nyanja came back. Later in his life, he collaborated with Atisha, Lord Atisha, on many translations. And then he received his final monk's ordination from Dorje Senge. Who's Dorje Senge? Diamond Lion. Yeah, he wrote the famous 8 verses, Lojong. He wrote the Lojong that His Holiness teaches so often. So we have a big connection with the Niguma lineage, through the second Dalai Lama and through the Kadampas, that teaching that the Dalai Lama gives all the time, right? Almost every time you see His Holiness, he's teaching Diamond Lion's 8 verses, right? The 8 verses Lojong. So That's how the lineage comes down to Padmadrupa. I'll skip about 9 generations because you all fall asleep and it's warm. Then it comes down to Bhutan Rinpoche. Bhutan Rinpoche had something like 6 lineages of Chakrasambhara, many other tantric lineages, and he's responsible for putting together the Kangyur and the Tengyur. All the scriptures that come down to us from ancient India were put together in their final form by Bhutan Rinpoche. We wouldn't have 4,500 scriptures from ancient India if it wasn't for Bhutan Rinpoche. And we wouldn't have them now on disk if it wasn't for John Brady. But anyway, this is Bhutan Rinpoche's big contribution. Then we skip one generation, and the next person to receive the 6 yogas is Jetsun Khampa. Okay? And people say, you know, people say, oh, the Gelugpa people, they don't have the 6 yogas of Naropa. They don't study the 6 yogas of Naropa. Jetsun Khampa studied it. He received that teaching and Padmadrupa's teachings at the age of 17, when he was 17, in the monasteries of the Digung Kagyu. So he got that teaching very early. And then later in his life, after Drebung Monastery was built, this is very late in Jetsun Khampa's life, maybe in the final 5 years of his life, he taught it to people. And he wrote down the instructions in a special book. And Christy Law is going to talk about that book. I'm not going to talk about it. But that's the basis. That book is the basis for our study in the monastery of Naropa's 6 yogas. Okay? So it's interesting, I think, Jetsun Khampa didn't pass it on to the first Dalai Lama, who was his student. He passed it on to Kedugje. Kedugje is this interesting Lama, student of Jetsun Khampa, because his 2 great interests, logic and tantra. Okay, so again you see this connection between thinking straight and then thinking like a yogi, okay? And there's a big connection there, and you have to follow it. It passes down through many other generations, finally reaches Purbuchok, who was the tutor of the last Dalai Lama. And he wrote all the textbooks that we study in Sera or Jebung or Ganden on, guess what? Logic. Okay, the courses in the ACI notebooks were based on Purbuchok. So Purbuchok was the teacher of the last Dalai Lama, and he was a big logician, but he held this lineage secretly, the 6 yogas of Naropa. Then it comes down to the current Dalai Lama, who taught it to the 2 teachers, the 2 holy lamas, from which Christy and I received the teaching. That's Geshe Chimne Dokye, who's Gyume Khyentse Rinpoche. He's the abbot, former abbot of Gyume Tantric College, and he gave us the entire teaching. He went through the whole text of Jetsun Khampa word by word with us and taught us the yoga, asanas, and the instructions. I just heard like a few weeks ago that I believe he's been selected to be the next Ganden Chupa, which is the next holder of Jetsun Khampa's throne. That's the head of all Gelugpas. His Holiness is the head of all Tibetan Buddhism. The head of all Gelugpas is the Ganden Chupa. And then we received the entire instructions a second time from Geshe Thupten Rinchen, who's, I think, the greatest scholar in India of Tibetan Buddhism. He's never taught in the West because he doesn't want to come to the West. But anyway, not yet. But he did the whole thing with us again. So that's your lineage. That's where you're getting this text. We translated Jetsun Khampa's explanation of the 6 yogas. And you'll be getting a little piece each day of that commentary. Okay? But it's important to know that you have a pure lineage. And I think the reason I spend so much time on your lineage and on all the teachers is that I think, you know, in Buddhism we say that each of them was already a Buddha long ago, and they went through their whole life to show us what we're supposed to do. You see what I mean? They went through their whole life to demonstrate to us what we're supposed to do. So I think of Tilopa in terms of death meditation, like getting serious about thinking about your death, meditating about your death all the time. And then I think of Naropatha in terms of being willing to give up money, position, comfort. You know, he had it made. You know, he had it made, like we do. We're all comfortable. And whatever you're at now, whatever kind of house you have, whatever kind of family you have, whatever kind of car you own, whatever kind of job you have, knowing what Tilopa knew about death, might it be appropriate at some time to emulate Naropa? You see? Might it be appropriate to give up what you have and go and commit yourself to learning Naropa's yogas, for example? You see? I think that's the lesson that Naropa can teach us. Again, Marpa, I think the lesson I get from Marpa is you can be a family person, you can have a business, and you can be the greatest yogi around. Okay? And that's what I think we can learn from Marpa. Milarepa, I think the story there is persistence when your lama is testing you. And then when you finally get the instructions, even if you're already 50 or 60 or 70, you go and you do them, you know, and you don't think it's too late, right? However old you are, it's time to start now, right? Better late than never, right? So I think that's what I learned from Milarepa, to have the courage to go in a cave at the age of 50. And he spent 12 years in the cave, you see, with no food. And, I mean, amazing. So then Gampopa, being willing to give up even your dear family to do your practice. And then I think Pamodupa, doing your yoga exercises. Okay? Very serious about the connection between your outer body and your inner body, right? How do you get out of dying? How do you stop death itself? How do you fulfill what Lord Buddha promised? You know, I can help you get over birth and sickness and old age and death itself. Nobody talks about that nowadays, right? They come and give you some Lam Rim teaching and leave town. They come and give you some initiation and leave town, right? They don't sit there and say, you don't have to die, you don't have to get old. Teach me how, right? Pamodrupa, in my mind, is like giving us an example. You do the yoga, you do Naropa's yoga, you see. What is that? Part of it is about your outer body. Part of it is about what people are doing in yoga studios, 20 million American people. Part of it's about that. But you need to know how to work on your inside, how to change the chakras, how to change the channels. And we were talking last night, if you weren't here, you can use it. You can use the deeper knowledge. You can reach into reality and change reality. You can have a fatal illness and you can change it. You can remove it from your body. You can be poor, you can get rich, you can be friendless, you can become most popular person, right? You can be surrounded by beautiful people all day. You just need to know yoga, the deeper yoga. And that's what we're here for this weekend. Okay, I think that's really what we're here for this weekend. So Pamodrupa's yoga, right? And how it came down to us. We're going to spend the rest of the time working on that. How do you work on the surface level? Exercises. How do you go deeper to your breathing exercises? And then how do you go deeper into the chakras themselves? How can you remove the demon of old age itself? How can you remove the demon of sickness? You know, is it possible for normal American people to do that? It is. And you can use Naropa's six yogas. And you should do it, okay? Should do it. So I thought, that's my pep talk, okay? I thought we would take a break. And then what I thought we would do, Christy Law is going to talk a little bit about Jetsam Kapa's text, which I think you're going to get during the break, is that true? Yeah, you'll get the first installment during the break. And then after that, we'll talk a little bit about the six yogas of Naropa. They begin with your body, your physical body, yoga, on the outside. And then they continue into your inner body, which is yoga on the inside. Okay? The six yogas are set up that way. They go from outer yoga to inner yoga. And you need to know the whole range. So we'll do that after some refreshments. Christine and I will be sitting... you want to go down there?
Yeah.
we'll sit down there, and during the break, if you just want to come up and say hi, if we haven't seen you in a while, or something like that, just come up. And if there's too many people, don't worry, we'll be doing that every break, okay? All right? So please have a nice break, have some refreshments, and then we'll start back in like 10, 15 minutes. Christy Lau is going to speak about this text by Jetsun Kapa, and especially about the meaning of the title of the text. Okay.
So the title of this text is called Yiche Sumden, which means the book of three beliefs, or having three beliefs. Yiche is belief, and sum is three, and den is like to possess. And in Sanskrit, that's tripatyayan, tree meaning three, because Sanskrit is so close to English, you can almost recognize the words without people telling you. And pratyaya meaning belief. And it's very interesting in the actual texts, the Book of Three Beliefs, Jetsun Kapa doesn't make it clear what the three beliefs are. He just assumes that we know. It was in Jetsun Kapa's time a very common phrase, the three beliefs, and everybody knew it like the six perfections, you know? Just off the top of your head, you could probably ask the majority of people in this room, what are the six perfections? And you could just rattle them off. But of course, in our time, we don't know what the three beliefs are anymore. That hasn't been passed down to us as well as the six perfections. So Geshe-la and I, we searched the ACIP database, and we found a definition of the three beliefs, and we stuck it in your reading. So that's the beginning. That's the first thing that you're going to get in your reading, which you're not going to look at till after the class, right? And we found it in a book also by Jetsun Kapa on his teaching on the Kala Chakra Tantra. And it's a really obscure text because it's actually just his notes. It's not really a full book. So what he says about the three beliefs is, well, most people say you need the three beliefs in order to practice the second level of tantric teachings, which is the completion stage. There are two levels of tantra. There's the creation stage and there's the completion stage. And the creation stage is like creating a perfect world around you and then living in it. Briefly, that's that's what it is. And then the completion stage is using outside methods like yoga to transform your inner body and change your body into light. So Jetsun Kapa says, most people think that you only need these three beliefs for the completion stage, Tantra, but really, you need the three beliefs for both stages of Tantra. So what are the three beliefs? Well, first of all, we have to discuss the word belief, which we said in Sanskrit was pratyaya. And, you know, it's really interesting. That word not only means belief, but it means kind of a proof or a certainty or a conviction about something. So he's not talking about belief in terms of blind faith. He's talking about something that you've come to a logical conclusion about, that you believe based on a very cold, calculated, logical conviction in your heart, you know? So the first of the three beliefs is after you receive a tantric initiation, you have to gain a belief in the teachings themselves. in the tantric teachings that will be passed down to you. And the reason why they say you have to gain a belief in these teachings is because these aren't like sutra teachings. Tantra is a little bit different. In sutra teachings, things make a lot of sense to us. Like, we had the practice, if any of you were there last night, of doing tonglen, giving and taking. You know, you take someone's pain and then you give them good things on your breath. And we understand logically that doing that meditation would help us. You know, it makes sense. It's like, oh, that would make me a kinder person and that would open up my heart. You could just think about it. You can think, what is that doing in my mind? Oh, okay, it's opening my heart. And we don't really need belief in it so much because it's obvious. But in the tantric teachings, things are not always that obvious. You know, people get an initiation and then the lama says, okay, sit down in this hut and do this mantra of syllables that you don't understand 100,000 times and come back to me later, you know? And they don't explain it and you don't know what it means and you don't know how in the heck it's going to help you get enlightened. You know, I mean, it's not logical. It's not clear. It's not obvious. So we need in order to practice something like that, in order to go into the hut and do the mantra, we need a belief in that the teachings are going to work for us. Well, there are a couple different ways we can go about this belief. Well, we could do the practice and see if it works. You know? And then we would have what they call in Tibetan a ngunsum sema, a direct perception based on your actual experience that something works. Or you could just sit and try as hard as you can to figure out why doing a mantra would help you get enlightened. And if you could figure it out, that would be a logical deduction of, you know, of how it would work. But really, in order to even try them, in order to even get to the point where you would be making a logical deduction or be trying them and seeing if they work, you have to rely on the third kind of perception, which they call lungi sema in Tibetan. It's a perception based on the scriptural authority or based on the authority of someone that you trust, like a lama. And another word for that is yiche jpak. And you see this word again, yiche. You know, belief. Jpak, based on a logical deduction. You know? So that brings us to the second of the three beliefs that we need to have. I think in order to have the first belief, when you're starting your tantric practice, a belief in the teachings enough to put them in the practice wholeheartedly and not just give these half-hearted efforts that won't really bring results. In order to put them into practice, you need to have a belief in the Lama who gave you the practice. So that's the second of the three beliefs, is belief in your Lama. So at the beginning, when you're going to get the initiation, you have to have a certain kind of relationship with this particular lama where you know, one, they care about you very deeply and would do anything that they could to see you get enlightened. And two, they've actualized these things to the point where they could guide you to enlightenment. They know what they're talking about, you know? And once you have this strong conviction in your lama, you don't have to question strange advices about the teachings or about what you should and shouldn't do. You can just trust that this being is someone who will guide you to enlightenment. You can put your life in their hands and not really have to rack your brain or worry too much about it. And that's where we all want to be in our tantric practice. We want to have that belief, that conviction so strongly that we don't have any question. We don't have any worry anymore about what we should or should. The third belief is a belief in ourselves. And we can also gain this kind of belief by going through the path and actually realizing something. And once you get results, you say, oh, I got from step one to step two. I could probably go to step three and four and five and six, you know? So once you get realizations, you gain a belief in yourself, right? But what about all of us who don't have realizations yet? Well, that also depends a lot on the Lama, on their authority. Because we don't have as much belief in ourselves as our Lama has in us. Our Lama can see our ultimate potential. They can stare at us and see the future when we will actually become enlightened. And you can gain a belief in yourself by seeing that through their eyes. You can see your own highest potential through them. Another way that you can gain belief in yourself through your Lama is by understanding that you created your Lama. That you are, your Lama is empty, right? And they are the highest emanation of your pure thoughts. You know, they are the best reality you've got going for you right now. You know? So you can look to them and say, wow, I made that being. I might not be experiencing that reality in this part of my projection, but I'm experiencing it in that one being out there. And if I can experience it out there, then that means I can reach it myself. So that is the third of the three beliefs. And I was going to talk also about the opening lines of Jetsun Kapa's text. In all the texts in Tibet, they do these opening poems of praise, and depending on who they're praising, it tells you what kind of a text it is. What's the subject matter? They sneak it into the opening poem in this really beautiful way. So the beginning words of Jetsun Kapa's book, and I suppose in Tibet they weren't even that fond of titles, so this is the first words that you would even see in the book, is I bow down to my Lama Vajradhara. So this is telling us that we're dealing with a tantric book, you know. This is the tantric emanation of Lord Buddha. And then he says, who is ever present, who is the creator of all things. Well, this kind of starts to sound like all of those theistic religions we rejected when we came to Buddhism. You know? And in a way, Tantra goes back to that. You know, in Sutra, you're like, there is no God. And then all of a sudden in Tantra, you're like, hey, Lama is God. You know? But the difference is, it's a God that we are creating through our karma. And it's something we have the ultimate control over. You know, so we have the ability to create a being who could have the power to reach out their hand and pull us up to heaven. You know? And so, is our Lama a Buddha? Is our Lama Vajradhara? Well, is there a Buddha? If there is a Buddha, and they are completely compassionate, and they can emanate at the speed of thought as many bodies as they could to help every living being, and they love you so much, wouldn't they be emanating someone for you? I mean, it's just logical, if there is a Buddha, that they are emanating beings for you to teach you how to get to enlightenment. And most likely, they're emanating the purest being that you can see at this moment, which would be your Lama. Of course your Lama is the Buddha. So, Shatsang Kapa says, creator of all things and ever-present. That's a huge claim, that your Lama exists around you in all things. But if Lord Buddha could emanate one being to help you, they could emanate a thousand. And if they loved you, they would. So, and there's plenty of stories in the scriptures of Lord Buddha emanating as even inanimate objects like a bridge or the sound of the wind through the trees in order to teach people, in order to bring them closer to enlightenment. So your entire reality could be an emanation of your Lama, Vajradhara. How does it help us to think in this way? Well, the more we practice seeing our world in this way, the more it will just appear to us like that. You will meet someone in a deli, and they will start saying holy Dharma things to you and just walk away. You know? Or you will be sitting on the ocean, and suddenly the sound of the waves will put you into a meditative state where you suddenly realize the true nature of impermanence. So it's really crucial that we think this way. It's the reason why we could become enlightened in this lifetime. It's the reason why we could purify the entire world around us by using the knowledge of our Lama, who is Vajradhara, emanating to get us enlightened. And that is the basis of all tantric practice. That's all I have to say.
Hi. It's just about dinner time, but I thought it's auspicious in case somebody... No, I won't say that. But anyway, you should at least hear what the six dharmas, the six practices of Naropa are. By the way, they're not called yogas in Tibetan, but it's such a popular name that I just kept it that way. They're called the six dharmas or the six instructions of Naropa. And again, they are abbreviated from the 12 that he got from Tilopa each time he got beaten up or whatever, okay? And there's a debate, even in Tibet, Jetsun Khapa mentions it, about the number of them. Some people say eight, some people say four, some people say six, some people say a different six. I think they're all right, they're just different ways of presenting it. There's a very famous Mongolian Lama named Chujing Aum Belmen, who lived in the end of the 1700s. He wrote a wonderful, he wrote a number of great books on tantric practice. And in fact, Kirti Tsenchab Rinpoche, I think, taught it last summer at Vajrapani and is continuing this summer. So if you can get there, that's very good, okay? It's a very great book. It's what we use in the monastery as our overview of tantric practice. So you should really try to catch that. He's an extraordinary lama, and to get that, I mean, without like 20 years of pain in the monastery is like a treasure, and if you don't get it, you're crazy. But anyway, so Chujing Aum Belmen, in one of his texts, in fact in that text, he says, I think the real intent of the six yogas is like this, and he presents an order of them which I think is really good. And so that's the order I'm going to teach you. You'll see a slightly different order in Jetsun Khapa's text. And I think that's because he's just reporting what one version. But here's the one I think, this is Naum Pelvin's version, which I think is very powerful. The first of the six yogas of Naropa, he's called Tummo. And you know Tummo. Tummo means inner fire, usually associated with the area of the navel. In Sanskrit, it's Sandali. Tsanda came into English as kanda and is found in the word candle or incandescent or incense. That's why they're spelled with a C. It means fire, like inner fire. So Tummo is an inner fire. That inner fire is essential in order to become enlightened and to change the body and remove illness from the body, remove mortality from the body, okay? So you need inner fire. In order to get inner fire, there's a preliminary called Trungkor. Say Trungkor. Trungkor means machine, okay? A machine. And it's an ancient word, because in ancient times in India, they had these big wooden gears, like for irrigation systems and pulleys. And they even had like merry-go-rounds and things like that. There are stories about those in the scriptures. So Trungkor means like a magical device. In Sanskrit, it's yantra, okay? Meaning like a magical device. The two parts mean miracle and wheel. And so some people nowadays have been translating it miracle wheels, which is just not the point. Trungkor means a machine, pulleys and gears. Trungkor is the practices of physical yoga, okay? And so you need that before you start the six yogas of Naropa, okay? You need Trungkor as a preliminary before you start Tummo. Trungkor, which is the physical exercises of yoga, is meant to help you raise the inner fire. And Jetsun Khapa goes into the various yoga exercises. And you can see them in the book, in the Tibetan Book of Yoga. We use that book as the basis of that yoga session, how to do a yoga session according to the Tibetan style. So you can, all of them are in there and you can use it. Also, we were very interesting karma. That book was 1 week away from the publisher. We were supposed to submit it on a certain date. And we've had a crew of Tibetans in St. Petersburg for 14 years, cataloging all the manuscripts there, looking for special books that we've been looking for. I think next month they will finish 100,000 titles. They have typed in all the information for 100,000 manuscripts. A few days before this book was due, they emailed us and said they just found the only illustrations that I know of Naropa's yoga exercises, which is really cool. So we got them and we put them in the book, so you can see them in the book. But there's a very beautiful carvings of how to do the exercises properly. So you have, in order to get the first of Naropa's yogas, which is inner fire, you have to do Tungkhor. And Tungkhor is that yoga exercises, along with Lungjang. Lungjang means pranayama, okay? Special breathing exercises. So those two steps are external steps, and they help you raise inner fire. By the way, you shouldn't try either one, but especially you shouldn't try the breathing exercises without proper training, okay? They can really hurt you. They can cause a very serious unbalances in your body. So you should never do them without training, without a real, authentic instructions. You should not learn them from a book or try to do them out of a book. You'll just hurt yourself. That's just, you should know that, okay? And in general, yoga is not good to do without a teacher. We encourage people to have a live, authentic teacher around to train you to do it. Then you can do it by yourself after that, okay? So anyway, that's the first yoga. Is inner fire, tummo. That leads to gawashi. Say gawashi. And here's where the order differs a little bit from the other texts. Gawashi is found in the original 12 practices of Talopa. Naropa got the instructions on gawashi, which means the four kinds of bliss, the four levels of bliss. Naropa got these instructions in a very funny way. I won't go into it, but basically, Talopa told him to go get a girl and stay with her, you know. And then he did. Talopa first told him to go get a job, okay? I guess it always goes like that. Go get a job, and he went and worked as a blacksmith. And it was very hot, and his body was like, he got very skinny and he was very bad physical condition. Then Talopa told Naropa, go get a girl, stay with a girl. And he obeyed his lama, and he met a girl, he brought her home, he stayed with her. And then the next time, later Talopa saw him and said, what are you doing with this girl in your room? You know, you told me to get a girl. He says, if I had a real disciple and he had broken his vows like that, I would expect him to smash his male organ with a stone. And so Naropa did. I don't know if it's a coincidence, but it was right after that he got the name Naropa. That's when Talopa named him highest of all men, you know. Then Naropa, Talopa laughed and taught him the gawashi. Gawashi means four levels of bliss which arise in your body, especially through practice with your spiritual partner. So these are four levels of bliss. As the central channel begins to open, then your body goes through four stages of bliss. Four stages of bliss descending, four stages coming up the central channel. Real yogis can divide it into 16 and distinguish between the different kinds of prana moving. There's white prana and red prana, and real yogis can divide it, so they say 32 ways or something like that. So that's this whole practice of opening up your chakras. And we'll talk more about that, but that's the second one, is the four levels of bliss. Again, it's a physical practice. It's a practice that you use your body. So yoga, as we know it in America, is a very high, very authentic, like Iyengar yoga, or Anusara yoga, or Ashtanga, or Bikram, or all of these kinds of yoga, Shivananda, they are all very authentic kinds of yoga. And they were meant to help raise tummo, which opens the inner channels, and you go through the four stages of bliss. Okay, that then leads to something called gilu. Say gilu. Gilu means gilu means maya, means illusion, right? And lu means body, maya kaya, and it means your body changes into light. Okay, as the central channel opens, your body changes into light. And all these pictures in churches, I don't see any around here, but stained glass pictures of people with halos, or tankas with halos, and light coming off their body, those are for real, okay? Those are the real thing. You do get to that, okay? Everybody here in this room, you're very close. I said last night, right? You're very close. You're amnesiac yogis from your past life. You wouldn't be in this room if you hadn't practiced this for many thousands of lifetimes. We're just picking up where you left off. Maybe a little late in some cases, okay? But you've been through all this. You're just reviewing it. You created me, right? Christy Law just said, no, really. Your karma is making us come here. Your karma created this church and this evening, right? We're just a reflection of your own karma. You know, if your karma runs out, the microphone will break. No, really. You're creating this, you see? So you are very close to your goal if you are in this room, okay? And Gyulu, in the old days, they took a knitting needle and they pushed it through the upper part of your arm to see if you were getting there. And it would just pass through and you wouldn't feel it. Because sometimes they call Jalu. Jalu means rainbow body. Rainbow means if you look at a rainbow from a mile away, you see colors and shapes, right? And then if you walk up to the end of the rainbow, you can pass your hand through it, like that. It's insubstantial. But from a distance, it has clear outline, clear colors, right? So when you gain gyulu, jalu, when you gain the rainbow body, or the illusory body, magic body, right? Then you're, from the outside, you might look the same, or you might emanate a small halo once in a while, okay? Like that, okay? Under certain conditions, a person who is at your level or close to your level could pass their hand through your body. You see what I mean? And in the monastery, they check you every once in a while, see how you're doing, like a turkey, you know, and they poke you. And it's very beautiful. It's kind of fun. So that's miracle body. By the way, at that point, obviously, you don't have any more disease in your body. And when you come out of a yoga session and you feel younger, or you feel like more flexible, or for about an hour you feel like really kind of the endomorphin rush, right? That's just the central channel cracking open a tiny bit through the most crude means possible. Okay? Like twisting. It's like if you had a stuck kitchen pipe, sink pipe, and you took a hammer and banged on the outside. That's what yoga is. Okay? Like, try to open that knot in the channels by just banging on it. You know what I mean? And it takes hours, and the result is very minimal. But it's, in the long run, it's very useful, because you can make steady, measurable progress if you're persistent. Swami Shivananda called it jackass persistence. If you're just jackass persistent every day, you know, do those things, you will crack the channels. They will be cracked. You can get to them that way. And then you have to do Roto-Rooter also. You have to snake it also, okay? And that's the inner practices. The first one, which is, we're up to yoga number 4, I think, right? Is called, yeah? Uzel. Uzel means clear light, like Lama Uzel, okay? Holy Lama Uzel. So Uzel means clear light. It means the perception of emptiness, okay? The perception of emptiness. That's the Roto-Rooter method. Okay? Yoga is this crude, outer, but measurable, thank God, outer work, job, you know? And it's good to do it. You must do it. Chinan tabla tsoar bad, right? What's that mean? You're required, once you enter Tantra College, take a vow. I will chinan tabla tsoar bad. I will work from the outside and the inside. I will bang on the pipe, and I will do Roto-Rooter, you know? No, you take a vow when you enter Tantra. Okay? That's one of the eight mother vows, those of you who know. So you're vowing, you'll work from the outside and work from the inside. Clear light, step number four, yoga number four, is that whole exercise of attempting to see emptiness directly. And clear light is the point at which you experience emptiness directly. Yoga was a method in the old days of triggering that experience. Okay? Like, it helps to bang on the pipe to get the roto-rooter started. You see what I mean? The proper yoga, physical yoga, can trigger more quickly a direct perception of emptiness. So that was the whole idea. And again, you can't do the physical yoga if you don't, I mean, you have to tunkor, you have to do, somebody has to train you in the proper methods. There's good yoga and there's better yoga, okay? Most of the yoga done in the United States is good. And it's fine if you do it. They're all authentic poses. And then, you know, if you have a close teacher who can observe your own grantees, the knots that you happen to have in your body, in your psychic channels, they can help you open them, you see? Step number five is called Sungjuk. Somebody asked me, Andriana asked me, what is that in Sanskrit? And we looked it up. It's called Yuga Nadha. Y-U-G-A N-A-D-D-H-A Yuga Nadha. And you'll never guess what the other Tibetan word for that is. Okay, Sungjuk. Sungjuk is the tantric word for enlightenment. In Tibetan, you don't call somebody Buddha when they use tantra to get enlightened. You don't say, oh, they reached Sangye or Changchu or Buddha. You say, oh, they reached Sungjuk. Sungjuk means the combination of the two. The combination of the two. Okay? Yoga. Okay? Very interesting. And there are many, many levels of that. One is hatha. What's hatha? Hatha. Okay? Hatha. This is ha, this is ta. Two channels coming this way. Okay? Sun channel and moon channel. Ha is Surya. Ta is Chandra. Sun and moon channels. So, when you change your body, gyulu, when you reach that body of light, which you will, these two side channels collapse. And then you gain the union of ha and ta. And that's what hatha yoga means. Okay? Hatha yoga. So sungjuk means that kind of combination. Sungjuk is one way to say it in Tibetan, and the other translation of it in Tibetan is yabyum. Okay? Yabyum is the other Tibetan translation of the same word. Yuga Nada. Sungjuk. Combination of the two. I always think of Janis Joplin, combination of the two. We'll play it. Anyway, it reminds me of that somehow. Anyway, the sixth yoga, in this system, in Ngawang Pelden's system, it got reduced to number six. And he just threw all the other yogas into there. Okay, it's called Poa Chongjuk. Say Poa Chongjuk. These are last-ditch efforts that you can make if you're about to die. Like if you get hit by a car tonight, you can try to do Poa Chongju, okay? If you don't have time to do all your yoga properly and change your body into light and get Tummo and perceive emptiness directly, if you're like drastic measures, you know, if you get really sick or you have really immediate danger of dying, then you can try to do Poa or Chongju. Poa means ejecting the consciousness from the body through preferred areas, okay? And that's a long teaching. Chongjuk, chong means dead. Juk means to enter. And this is a special practice where you could actually, if it's like an organ transplant, like if there's a fresh body that the consciousness has just moved out of that body and the body has not decomposed yet, and if you were had an accident or you were very ill, you could transfer your consciousness into that other body and it would become alive again. And there are stories in Tibet of this and it's kind of cool. But in our lineage, okay, in the Galupa lineage, in our practice of six yogas, we de-emphasize number six. We don't spend any time on it and Jetsun Kapa doesn't spend any time on it. Why? We went to CNN. They asked me to translate His Holiness. There was a movie about His Holiness. And they had trouble translating some of the sections of it. And so we went to the studios in New York and we sat down and they played the video. And this old nun comes up to His Holiness in Dharamsala and says, nature ki dunya shegi yo, you know, which is very rare in Tibetan. And nature means there's a specific kind of pain you get as you die. Okay? And it's the worst pain you can imagine. It's like 40,000 root canals in the same moment. No, really. Like it's a new level of pain that you've never experienced in your whole life. And normal people, if you haven't done six yogas or something similar, you will have it. So this nun is coming up to the Dalai Lama in this film clip and the point is, as you there's the standard series of hallucinations that you go through. Very severe hallucinations that you go through. And again, you're in the deepest pain you can imagine. So it's like the last, it's like the worst moment of your life to try to do some spiritual practice. It's like not meditating for a year and then trying to meditate on New Year's Eve in the last half minute or something. No, it's probably worse than that. And everyone's already drunk. You're already drunk on champagne, you know. No, and then you're going to get some high spiritual practice happening to you in the last half minute of the year. It doesn't work, okay? I mean, it's too late. And you're in such incredible pain, and your mind itself is shutting down. It's unlikely. It's like they say it's as common as a star coming out at noon in the sky, you know, for someone to succeed at that. So they really de-emphasize it. If you're going to get to heaven, do it now. You know, then go back and do all that other stuff you wanted to do after that. You see what I mean? Get it done now while you're alive. Okay, so we don't, yoga number six, we don't spend much time on that. Poor Tongjuk. I mean, the instructions are there. You can learn them if you need it. But the idea is, while you're alive, while you're healthy, while you have a teacher, while you're, you know, have a good job, good family, good house, get it done, for goodness sake. And then you can relax after that. You can do whatever you want after that. Finish your six yogas now. Enter paradise now. And then, you know, you can take care of seeing the rest of the movies that are out this year and stuff like that, okay? The other stuff, okay? Those are the six yogas of Naropa. We'll start going through the practice of the six yogas after dinner. I think we'll do dinner for exactly an hour, starting now. So what time is it? 20 after? Ew. Sorry. Let's start at 8:30. Okay? Is that all right? And I'm sorry about today. There was a wedding here, and we didn't want to crash them. So. So we'll start at 8:30. We won't go too late. I know it can run late. So we'll give away the karma. Okay? Put it in the bank. If you get irritated during dinner, you will lose all the karma from this talk. Seriously. So that's why we dedicate. Because that puts it in the karmic bank account. Okay? So, I don't know. Kimberly? Kimberly? You're the yoga lady. Put your hands like this or in a mandala if you know how. Thank you. See you at 8:30. Okay. Have a good dinner.